Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. The 2016 Dakota Midday Book Club kicks off with a book about fly fishing. Of course, it's really a book about an ethic and a philosophy of living in the natural world. Dave O'Hara is the author. He's also a professor at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. I sat down with him at the SDPB studios in Sioux Falls for this conversation. I would consider this an ambitious book in the sense that you're trying to describe some things that even while you're doing them, you can't describe. So there's a scene you're fishing with your son, and you say, "Nice job." And he says, "Wow." And that's the words that you can come up with. So how did you approach trying to describe something like wonder and relationship and fly fishing in words in a book? Where did you even begin to approach that as a writer?
That's a good question. I remember, I think I did that several times in the book where I said something like, wow, and realized that was the only word that I had. I'm a philosophy professor, and I often go back to the ancient philosophers. I think of Aristotle, for instance, who says that the love of wisdom begins in wonder. And for me, that's enough reason to cultivate wonder and to try to go to those places and indulge in those experiences that provoke the most wonder in us. Sometimes, of course, when you're talking about those liminal moments, those times and places of wonder, we really don't have the words for it. And that does make it difficult as a writer, but that's still worth trying for me anyway.
How does the cultivation of wonder change as you age? As a child, it came very naturally. Does it come as naturally for you as an adult?
I think one of the biggest challenges to cultivating wonder as we get older is that when you tell somebody that you wonder about something, it comes across as an admission of ignorance. Mm. You know, you don't wonder about what you already know. You wonder about what you don't know. And you wonder about those things that are kind of transcending our ordinary experience. So there's a lot of reasons why adults are afraid to admit that we wonder at things. It doesn't make us look like we know what we're doing at our job or like what we know what we're doing as parents or in economics or in politics. So how do you cultivate it? I think you kind of have to remember your inner child and allow that inner child to come back out.
And you have a story that when you were here with Carl Gerke, you told the same story, but it's so worth telling it again because that was a few years ago. It's in the book. You're in sixth grade, and you sort of steal away from the playground, ditching the playground monitors. To do what?
My friend Bowie Keppen and I, we had this great big field, many acres of a field that was right next to our elementary school. And we'd go out there for recess, and it was bordered by woods. And right at the edge of the woods, there's a little path. And we'd go in that path, and then we'd go down to the stream. We weren't allowed to go down to the Sawkill Creek, but we went anyway. Because you can lie down on these great big flat stones and just put your face near the water and watch all the things swimming in there and sometimes get a little soaked as you climb in and pick up rocks and see what's underneath. And, it was a great place for an elementary school. So, yeah, Bowie and I went out there during recess, and we kind of snuck away from the playground when the playground monitors weren't looking. And once we were in there, in the stream, we decided, even though we heard the whistle, it was time to go back, we weren't going back. And what I think what was best about that was Mr. Van Bramer, who was our teacher at the time, he was obviously upset. When we got back to our classroom, we realized that the whole school was doing a search for us. He was upset, but he was also glad to see that we were okay. You know, we wandered back after an hour or so. But he didn't rebuke us. You could see in his eyes that he felt a professional obligation to tell us, you don't do that. And at the same time, you could see that he really was glad that we were doing what we did.
Right.
And what was even more rewarding was how a couple months later, he took us all as a class back out to the stream. I think he recognized this is where education happens.
Yeah. He waited for an appropriate period of time.
Yeah.
and then he took you all back.
You don't want to reward that sort of thing immediately, but yeah, he knew it was good.
Do you still feel that as an adult sometimes, that sort of desire to steal away and just be gone for a little bit?
I do, yeah. And one of the things that I've tried to do is to teach abroad as often as I can. And by abroad, I simply mean outside of the classroom. So I teach philosophy, I teach classics, ancient Greek language. What I like to do, though, is take my students outdoors. We go and sit under a tree If I'm teaching environmental philosophy, for instance, we'll sit outside under the tree and we'll talk about the stuff we've been reading, but I'll also ask my students to look at the ground and tell me what they see. And I love it when they say, oh, what are these little lumps of dirt right there? Oh, those are worm castings. Worm castings? What are they? You know, or every now and then somebody will find a raptor pellet, which usually grosses people out. You know, it's the bones and fur that a hawk has tossed back up after eating its meal. But these become moments of just sheer delight and wonder. Yeah. My ancient philosophy class, every year during the Orionid meteor shower, I try to take them out to the Badlands, and we camp out. And we sleep on cots or just sleep right on the ground and watch the stars all night long. I suppose you could say that that's not really education, because there's no papers, there's no quizzes, no exams, no grades. I just tell them, if you want to come, you can come. And usually about half the class does. And everybody who does says, wow, that was one of the best things I did in college.
Yeah. I did that this summer with friends.
Same thing, lying out under the stars.
Somebody had a lawn chair, and it laid all the way back, and we just stayed there and slept and watched and wondered and didn't talk very much, really.
Yeah.
You know, for quite a long time. It was spectacular.
One of the coolest things I think about that is you get to see the Milky Way turn. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, you know, we'll glance up at the stars, but we don't stay there and watch them.
Yeah.
But I remember that the development of science in the West happened because people took the time to watch the stars all night long.
Hmm.
You know, Galileo was doing that. But even before him, people like Aristotle and Thales were doing that, just staring up at the sky, watching the stars and saying, what can I learn from this?
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the book and fly fishing. I've never been fly fishing, and yet this book just really reached out to me from the cover and the title and the description on the back. Enjoyed every word of it.
Thank you.
Do you get that response from other readers who say, I don't have experience with fly fishing, but this? Thank you for writing this book.
A little bit. I'm not a very good book promoter, so mostly I write things and I let them go, and then I go back and I write something new. So I don't get to have many conversations like that. But yeah, I do like to teach people to fly fish. And when I do, I often find that people have that response. There's something very different about fly fishing. And I'm not opposed to other kinds of fishing, but with fly fishing, you're trying to think like the fish. You know, if you put bait on a hook, then, you know, you're just trying to attract the fish by the smell or by the way, you know, that it looks like a big chunk of meat, and they'll eat it. That makes sense. When you're fly fishing, you're trying to think, what does the fish see right now? What's the fish's world like? What insects are rising from their larval stage up to their adult stage to mate? Which ones do I see in the air right now? Do I see cicadas? Do I see mayflies? Do I see caddisflies? And then what I see, I try to tie onto my line, and then I put it out there and make the insect look as much like an insect as I can. It's not perhaps a very efficient way of getting food for your family, but I think it's probably a really good way of trying to make contact with another part of the world that otherwise I'd just drive by.
You must never master it as an art. Am I thinking about that in the right way? You could progress and you could have a successful day, but never really feel like you have it 100% down.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in fact, a number of the people that I know who fly fish even work to make it more challenging for themselves. And that probably sounds silly, but if you think about it, a lot of the best things that we do are setting up challenges that we don't need. Take football, for instance. I mean, there's nothing that says that we need to get a piece of inflated leather down a field and then turn around and try to get it the other way, right? I mean, you know, we set up these challenges for ourselves because the challenges themselves are worth doing. Mm-hmm. It's not that, you know, you gain more money by having a football run down the field. It's not that you gain more food by having fly fished more. But you gain a kind of experience and a kind of knowledge of the world and a knowledge of yourself that's in and of itself worth having.
Talk to me a little about the fly fish ethic that you sort of elaborate on, of what that process is and that connection that you have with the fish.
Yeah, so one of the things that we're trying to do, like I said, is to think like the fish, trying to understand the whole environment that the fish lives in. So part of the ethic then is that you pay attention to the quality of the water. You come to care for insect life. I didn't like bugs when I was young. And the more time I spend in water watching fish, the more I care about bugs, because the invertebrates are what feed the fish. And the water quality affects the lives of the invertebrates. You go to some of the streams in the Adirondacks and elsewhere in the Appalachians, they're crystal clear. Some of the streams in Maine, absolutely clear. And people say, oh, that's a healthy watershed because it's clear. Well, what they're missing is that actually there's high acidity in that water, and the acidity has knocked out all of the algae and knocked out all of the invertebrates. And so the water looks clear because it's poisoned. So the fly fisher is trying as much as possible to understand this environment and to think of it as being something to which I have an ethical obligation. When we catch the fish, similarly, we try to take the barbs off the hooks, you know, so we leave a point, but you want to make it so that the fish can spit the hook if it needs to. You want to make it so that when you touch the fish, if you touch the fish, you do it in such a way that you're not doing it permanent harm unless you plan to take it home to eat it. So we wet our hands first, and then we pick up the fish. Or even better, we don't pick up the fish. We just hold it, cradle it in the water, and then release the hook from its mouth. And when you've done that, you don't just toss the fish back. You resuscitate it if you're not going to keep it. Allow it to sit there in the current and rest in your hand. Get to know the fish and give it freedom. When it wants to, when it's ready to, it'll swim away. But there are plenty of times when they'll just sit there in your hand, and they'll move their fins and move their tails, and you watch them breathe the water, and it's pretty amazing.
Did you learn that from other fishermen? From how so? Who taught you that process of it?
Yeah, probably three main sources. The most important source was my dad. Dad took me fishing when I was a little boy, and those were times when he was cultivating my wonder. Dad was an engineer at IBM and worked for NASA as well. And he's somebody who just, he's a born philosopher. He wonders about everything, and he passed that on to me. Second source would be books. You know, you read A River Runs Through It, Norman MacLean. You read books like that, Isaac Walton. Those books, they teach you quite a lot too. But I think probably the most important would be those other people who were like my dad, other anglers that I meet on the river. And just we watch one another, we talk to one another. We ask one another, how's the fishing? What are you doing? What are the fish like here? What's your ethic? You know, why are you doing what you're doing? We wind up having some amazing conversations on the river and afterwards as well.
Tell me how your dad experienced the woods. Did you watch him walking through the woods and notice how he did that as a child?
Yeah, in fact, Dad was very deliberate about this too. He took me into the woods quite a lot. I grew up in the Catskill Mountains in New York, and some of my ancestors, I've got a very, like many Americans, very tiny fraction of Native American ancestries, and some of them lived in those same woods 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, and Dad wanted me to try to pay attention to that and to think about what it was like for them to live there, how they related to the woods and to the game and to the rivers and the fish. So Dad would, he taught me to walk quietly. It's one of the things that I've enjoyed teaching my kids as well, just to walk without talking, not to step on sticks that are going to break and make noise, to walk slowly and quietly enough that you can take in what's out there, and even sometimes just to stand still. The other day I went out to Good Earth State Park here just outside of Sioux Falls and went for a walk, and I always see amazing things out there. And several times during the walk, I just stopped and, you know, thinking of my dad, what would Dad do? Just stop and listen. If you listen long enough, you'll realize that you've been hearing things and not noticing that you've been hearing them. But try it sometimes. Ask, how many different bird voices am I hearing? Ask, how many different animals am I hearing moving through the leaves? And you'll be hearing things you didn't even know you could see. You know, little rodents that are scurrying under the leaves, and squirrels, and then sometimes some pretty large animals as well, deer, for instance, or foxes. There's an awful lot to learn from the woods. And my dad, just the way that he walked through the woods, there's something just about the way that he carried himself that became a lesson for me.
And do you pass that on to your children intentionally? And do kids just sort of naturally explore in that same way, or do they need to be told?
Well, I think it is really important to allow kids every now and then to escape the playground and go play in the stream. And, I, you know, as Maria Montessori said, the work of children is play. So, you know, I don't want to make my kids' experience in the woods to be work, you know, or unpleasant. But yeah, there have been times when I've been intentional. We used to live in New Mexico as well, and we'd hike in the Sandias. And from time to time, I'd say to the kids, let's just be still and listen for a minute. And almost always there'd be something. We'd look up and there's an elk or a deer or something, you know. I do take my students outside quite a lot. I now teach a class in Guatemala and Belize 2 out of every 3 years. I teach in Greece almost every year. And I was just teaching in Alaska this last summer as well. It's a course that I'll probably teach some more. These are times when I can take not just my kids, but my students out into the woods. And we can walk quietly all day long. In Guatemala, I take them on a 4-day walk, about 45 miles through the rainforest. And we're walking on tiny foot trails that have been walked on by Mayans for thousands of years. And it's a great time just to be still and observe and smell and listen.
One of the moments in your book, which you really don't make a big deal about, but you mention it, is just sort of walking public access, getting access to the stream, and then entering at a public point and then walking down the stream for a long ways, and then just sort of, you know, declaring your right to be in the middle of the stream. So talk a little bit about how important and what are the challenges of really having access to lands and what that means to you.
Right. Yeah, and this is interesting. If you looked at a map of public access to water in the United States, you'd see that there's a big shift from the East Coast to the West Coast. You know, the folks who originally settled on the East Coast were taking with them a medieval European ideal that there should be something called commons, so places where anybody can graze their sheep or their cattle, places where anybody can go and get water for drinking or washing or cooking. And when the original settlers, European settlers, arrived in the Northeast, they maintained that ideal. So in Vermont, for instance, any stream that's big enough to float a log down is public access. You can go in it, you can stand in it anywhere, anytime. As you go further west, it was smaller numbers of people who were coming west and people who were coming looking to stake a claim. And the laws reflect that. So there are plenty of places where you may not enter the stream in the west. And not only where you may not enter the stream, but where if you do enter the stream, you may not stand on the bottom of the stream. So the bottom of the stream belongs to the landowner on either side. I think it's important. I think that you know, people like John Muir and Henry David Thoreau and Theodore Roosevelt and a number of other important Americans recognize that there are public lands that are a treasure for us. And they're not just a treasure because they're pretty. They're a treasure because they're places where we go to cultivate wonder. Think about the number of times that people go to a place like Glen Canyon or Arches National Park or Grand Canyon, you know, Mammoth Caves. Why do we go to those places? We don't go there because we're looking to prospect for gold. We don't go there because we're looking for food. There's some other part of us that we're trying to nourish. And it's like I said earlier, I think it's that sense of wonder. You know, we see that the petrified forest in Arizona, or we see the living forest north of San Francisco, and we go to these places and there some part of us comes alive that we didn't even know wasn't alive. There's some part of us that was asleep is now awake. Some part of us that we didn't know was hungry all of a sudden is getting food for it. We need those things, and I think especially our children need those things.
The book is beautifully written from start to finish. We should mention there's another author here. Sort of trade off with essays and stuff. But does writing come naturally to you?
No. I just had an email from a student last night. I've assigned an essay for one of my classes, and she's working on it over spring break. God bless her. And she said, I don't even know where to begin. How do I do this? And I began in my reply by telling her, I was in the same situation when I was a college student, and you have my permission to begin wherever it feels natural. What I even recommended to her that she start by writing a letter to her grandmother. You know, think about somebody that you know. Think about somebody that matters to you, and start trying to tell them what you see. For me, that's been really helpful as a writer. If I try to write in other people's style, if I try to follow that format, the 5-paragraph essay format you learn in middle school or anything like that, I find it comes out wooden and it doesn't feel right, and it's I feel like most of what I write becomes sterile and unimportant.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of writers who seem to be able to write directly from the heart, and they just, it's like they say what's going on inside them. Yeah. The poets do that for us. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of hymns do it for us as well, and that's the sort of thing that I'm trying to cultivate in myself as a writer as well.
I think you're there. As a reader, I mean, that's exactly what I felt, what you just described. So
you're very kind. Thanks.
you were in an accident.
Mm-hmm.
Have you written about that? Is that something that you will use in the future to sort of try to make sense of as a writer?
Yeah. So the accident that you're talking about happened last September when I was out boating with some friends here in South Dakota, and we were run over by another boat, and I wound up with a traumatic brain injury. I woke up in the hospital, my wife standing over my bed saying, "You just had two brain surgeries," and there was still another to come. It was pretty frightening for me as an author and as a professor, because I lost my ability to write. I couldn't hold a pen for a long time. I tried typing and I couldn't get my fingers to find the keys. I'm also a philologist, a linguist, and I've studied a lot of languages. And one of the first things I noticed was that I'd lost one, and I was afraid to test to see if I'd lost any others. Portuguese was simply gone. The good news is that a lot of that stuff has been slowly coming back. And one of my exercises, one of my brain exercises to try to restore my ability has been to write. I've been trying to teach myself more languages and trying to translate and to just sit and write. It's been very hard to write. I used to be able to sit for hours at a time and write, and now I find a few minutes and I'm pretty tired. Mm. But it's like anything else. When you have an injury, exercise makes it come back at least a little bit. What I'm very grateful for is that last summer, when I was teaching in Alaska and then doing research up in the Arctic, I wrote every day, and I still have my journals. So for me, one of the best ways to return to writing has been to go back and reread my journals. And I find that I find my own voice again. And if I read a few pages of my journals, I can turn open a new page in my journal and start writing. There's a lot there that I'll probably write about soon. And yeah, I'll probably wind up writing about the accident as well.
What does it mean as a father to know that your sons are in downstream the book with the experiences? They've grown a little bit, I'm sure, since the book came out. Mm-hmm. What does it mean that they will have access to something that you've polished and published that has them in it and has a whole lot of you in it?
Well, I'll tell you, there's one thing I'm afraid of, and I'm afraid that it's hard to be the son of an academic. Mm. You know, I spent 11 years in college, and I have a PhD, and I think that for kids, you know, you look at the accomplishments of your parents, and sometimes it feels like that's going to be the thing that you're going to be measured against. So if my sons ever listen to this radio broadcast, I hope they hear me say, "I don't ever intend to measure you against that, guys." I really love, though, the opportunity to share with them the things that matter to me. And as they've now become adults, I love having them come home and share with me the things that matter to them. Mm-hmm. I mentioned in one of the chapters in there that I brought my older son, Michael, fishing in Maine, and it was pretty rough with him. He wasn't much of an outdoorsman at the time. He was pretty young, and we made him camp out and stay in a tent, and there were bugs everywhere, and he was all bitten up, and it was hard until he caught his first brook trout. Great, big, healthy 19-inch brook trout, and he came alive. He just wrote me a text about a month ago saying that he had just finished another wilderness first aid course, and he's become a backpacking tour guide in Vermont, and he's an EMT, and I think probably one of the things that he loves the most now is spending nights in the mountains. So will he ever be a fly fisherman? He fishes a little bit. Mm. It doesn't really matter to me whether he picks up my hobbies, but I want to live an imitable life, the kind of life that's worth imitating, even if not in the details. I want them to live lives of wonder and curiosity and delight in nature. And when they have kids, maybe they'll have other things to pass on to them.
This is a book that tells some uncomfortable truths about man's relationship with the natural world, things that we've done to alter it, things that we've done to alter it that have failed, things we've done to resurrect water, for example, from our own damage. But yet I also found it to be a very hopeful book. Do you approach, you know, the stories that you read and your experience in the wild with a sense of hope?
I do, yeah. You know, we have done a lot of terrible things, as you say. We've covered over 1,000 miles of trout streams with debris from mountaintop removal in order to get coal in places like Kentucky and West Virginia. 1,000 miles of trout streams that are permanently buried. But then, you know, we buried trout streams on the island of Manhattan as well. There's certain things that you just can't help doing if you're going to continue to survive as a species. We've plowed things under here on the prairie. We've nearly wiped out the bison. We've done a lot of bad things, definitely. I don't think that there's reason to give up hope, though. Mm. The more time we spend caring about these things, the more time we allow ourselves to recognize that we have messed up, the more opportunities we have to look back on our lives and on the lives of our ancestors and ask, what can we make whole again? I'm the chair of the religion department at Augustana University, so I'm often thinking about these things in sort of a Lutheran way. I hope I'll be forgiven for that. You know, Luther says that we're going to mess up, yeah. That there's nothing that we can do that isn't going to somehow be tainted by ulterior motives. And at the same time, I really do think that our lives and our world are places that are full of grace. We could focus on just the bad things, and it's good for us to be attentive to them. But I would like us to focus just as much on the grace and the wonder and the beauty that is all around us and to embrace that.
Thank you for writing this book. I chose it as the first selection of the Dakota Midday Book Club since I've been here, and I chose it for a reason, with intention. I read it, and I am reminded what's important in life. The writing is beautiful. I'm happy that you're in South Dakota, and I'm happy that you participated or agreed to participate in this. So thank you.
Thank you. You honor me, I think, more than my writing deserves, but I'm very grateful.
And thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure.
Dave O'Hara is the author of Downstream, Reflections on Brook Trout, Fly Fishing, and the Waters of Appalachia. Our next Dakota Midday Book Club selection is called Really Happy. That one is by Jim Reese. It's a book of poetry by an award-winning South Dakota poet, and if you're already a member of our book club, your copy might just be in your mailbox right about now. If you'd like to support South Dakota Public Broadcasting with your membership dollars, the Midday Book Club is a great way to do so. To find out more, go online at sdpb.org/donate.